8 years after this began, inflation in Zimbabwe reached the sextillion percent. So,
what is that number you're saying? What is sextillion?
I don't actually know how many zeros that is.
Welcome to Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. I am Sonaline Wang. Today we are speaking with Dr. Simu Kachiguru, author of the memoir Chasing Freedom, Coming of Age at the End of Empire, published by Crown. He is a professor of African politics at Oxford University. Please note that this episode does contain references to physical punishment and miscarriage. Born in 1980 Zimbabwe, Dr. Chiguru is called a born free. What is the special meaning of this term, and how is it related to the once global British Empire? Let's find out.
So I was born in 1986. Now, I was born 6 years after Zimbabwe gained independence in 1980. What a lot of people don't know is that the land that we now call Zimbabwe was colonized by the famous Victorian imperialist Cecil John Rhodes, and this was in the late 19th century. Rhodes annexed 400,000 square kilometers of landmass and named it after himself, and the country was known as Rhodesia. And for nearly a century, the country was run as a de facto apartheid state. In other words, this was a country where there were white settlers, where black people lived in segregated communities, where they needed an internal passport to travel in their own country, where we were denied the vote, where the lion's share of land and commerce and industry was held by the white minority, like settlers who had come to live in the country. And it was basically apartheid in all but name. So from the early to mid 1960s, Africans, black people who were living in the country known as Rhodesia, you know, started to build momentum politically, demanding freedom, basically demanding the end of racial segregation, the end of white minority rule, and the institution of democracy for the country as a whole. The Rhodesian government was totally uninterested in relinquishing power, and this led to a violent uprising against its rule. And that's what we call the liberation struggle, the anti-colonial liberation struggle. And it basically turned into a full-blown war where black people on one side, nationalist movements formed political parties and armies that were rising up against this white supremacist minority government. And they fought in a war that went on for over 15 years before the country eventually gained independence in 1980. Now, I was born in 1986, so I was the first, part of the first generation that never lived under direct colonial rule in my home country. And they call my generation the born frees.
Because you were born after the freedom struggles, the
that's right,
the liberation, as you call it.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting that though you were a born free, there was still, and there is still, a profound sense of colonial presence, of British presence in this newish country of Zimbabwe, right?
That's right. So Zimbabwe is strange. You know, we were the last country in continental Africa to fly the British flag. So I think there's this kind of myth that British colonialism was something that happened a long time ago. It only ended in 1980. And then you had a society that was trying to reinvent itself after close to a century of colonial domination. So part of what that meant, you know, in practice was that schools were trying to desegregate public spaces from hotels to museums to swimming pools that were once, tightly controlled for white people's use only, now began to admit everybody. And then, of course, there were the big questions. What do you do about the government? What do you do about the army? What do you do with the white settlers who didn't want to leave the country but were trying to integrate into this, new politic? So it was a charged and difficult time, but also quite a heady and optimistic one. So my family had taken part in the anti-colonial liberation struggle, and we're now trying to enjoy the fruits of living free within their own country. My parents wanted to send me to the best schools that they could get me to, and yet when I got there, these were schools that were still teaching us a very British curriculum. We were deep in Africa, but learning about meadows and castles and kings, which had nothing to do with our local environment. We were reading.
So you said meadows, castles, and kings.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just repeating back to you because for some reason the sound was a bit muffled.
Yeah. And all of that. And as a child, it was a very strange thing to encounter because from about as early as I can remember, my father would tell me that I was lucky to be born into a country that was our own, that we could claim as ours. And he would tell me that my name, Simukai, means to stand up. And it means, to stand up against colonialism, in all its forms. He would tell me that he had fought in this torrid war, so that I could go to the kinds of schools I wanted to go to and go swimming on Saturdays and so on. So my earliest memories from home were already tied up with this idea that I was inheriting something great and beautiful. And at the same time, I was going to these schools which were steeped in whiteness and in the colonial past. The teachers at the schools I went to were white. They didn't want us to speak any of our local language. A lot of the culture, the sport, the books that we were reading were all inherited from Britain. And so before I had the words to express it, I felt a kind of dissonance between the messages I was getting at home about being, proud of being Zimbabwean, of being African, of being black, and then on the other hand, going to schools and institutions that were basically still run by white people. And I think this was the uneasy tension of Zimbabwe's transition into independence.
And to note, the school that you went to, the initial primary school, it was named Twin Rivers after an idea from India because a lot of the people invested in the school were from India. Like they were Asian Indians who had been living in Zimbabwe, or how's that situation?
Yeah, so in many parts of East and Southern Africa, there was a large diasporic community from South Asia, mostly from India, but also from Pakistan and Bangladesh. So, just to give an example, certainly people in the United States are aware of Zohran Mamdani as mayor of New York, and
New York
that
City,
his
yes.
Yeah, of New York City. And his dad and his parents, came, they came from Uganda, but were part of the Indian community in Uganda. And so there was an equivalent in Zimbabwe where I grew up. It's a small number, but it was there. And so one of the things that had happened during colonial times is there was a kind of hierarchy between the races, with white people on top, then Indian or South Asian people, then people of mixed race, and then black people. And so my primary school, I went to the small primary school called Twin Rivers. And even though it was started by the South Asian community, the teachers were a combination of white people, some of whom had been Rhodesians, and Indian people, but they had no black teachers, no African teachers when I started there. And so it's just a really unusual mix of different communities.
And I think it goes without saying, but let's just state it, that the administrators, the people who ran the school, were pretty much white.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
Sure.
you were a student at this mixed race primary school. But you remember being very anxious as a child, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was an incredibly nervous child. And I would get so anxious about pretty much everything. I hated the start of the new school year. I would feel terrified about every new teacher I was given, and then I'd get nervous about doing sports or doing the drama club, you name it. And it would come out in these ways, because again, I was too young to have any language to express it. So it'd come out in my body. I would have unexplained stomach aches and need to miss days of school. And it's only really from being an adult and looking back that I've started to make a little bit of sense about that anxiety. And part of it was that, my parents, in different ways, were both so traumatized from their experiences of war, that the home that we grew up in often felt very tense. It felt very charged with things I couldn't understand, loud noises late at night, or my father having a little too much to drink and not having his senses about him. My mother was also traveling a lot because she was working in the international women's rights movement and with UN organizations and so forth. And I just could feel the distance between my parents at these times. And I also felt the need to hold them together. And I think one of the things that happens when you're a kid and you think that things aren't okay is hope. You start to believe that if you are good enough, if you're sweet enough, that you can make your parents okay. That's one reaction that one can have to these to that kind of emotional atmosphere. And that was certainly how I had internalized it when I was growing up. And then that came out at school in this kind of nervousness and fear.
Well, and I think to add some context to this, so your father, when he was young and subsequent to protests against the segregationist, deeply racist Rhodesian government, he was tortured.
Yeah, so my father went to prison twice. Once when he was in high school, and then the second time when he was at university. The first time when he went to prison, this was the first big protest that he had taken part in, when he was finishing high school. Him and a group of other boys who were protesting the government had gone on a big march from their school into the nearest big town. They held up placards saying things like "Zimbabwe will be free." The reason they did this was the Rhodesian government was under growing pressure to relinquish white minority rule and to open up the country to democracy. And that pressure was coming internally from, political uprisings, but it was also coming through diplomatic channels. The British government at the time was basically trying to shed its empire and was having this weird relationship with the settler colony that it had set up in Rhodesia. And so the British had sent one of their diplomats into the country for talks with the Rhodesians to see if they would consider opening up the country to elections. All of this trickled down into the school where my father was, where he was recruited to take part in this protest so that they could grab the attention of the delegation of the British and kind of make a spectacle so that it was clear how unhappy the majority of the country was with Rhodesian rule. But the
Well,
Rhodesian
wait.
government.
So just to be clear, so this was during the 1970s, right?
Yeah, this was 1971.
And so in 1971, this was, of course, over a decade after the end of World War II, the United Kingdom was at that point been forced, basically, by economic circumstances following that war to let go of its former colonial possessions.
That's right.
And I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but there's this kind of like irony, right? Where Cecil Rhodes received a charter from the crown of Britain to set up Rhodesia, basically.
Correct.
And that was in the 1800s. And then in the 70s, in the 1970s, the Rhodesian government was so racist that even Britain wanted to disassociate themselves from it.
Exactly, exactly. It's a wild story, you know, because as you said, World War II comes to an end in 1945. Europe as a continent is reeling from all of the bloodletting of those years. And, you know, this was something that is a scar on the conscience of Europe and a deep questioning of the soul after all of the horrors that had just happened. And Britain's attention turns inwards, and it's an economic crisis and is trying to rebuild. And it, as you said, it can't keep hold of its colonial possessions. They're just way too expensive. And so it starts, you know, from the 50s, accepting for various African countries to start to govern themselves. You know, through the 60s, what's called a wave of decolonization sweeping through the African continent. And the kind of last bastion of resistance in the British Empire is in Southern Africa with these territories. And the Rhodesian government, you know, becoming sort of almost paranoid and besieged, you know, puts its feet down and refuses to let go. And Britain, you know, says, you know, even the colony that we set up is intolerably racist. And so there is an irony to it. It's an ugly and weird irony. And it's, you know, if you don't laugh, you cry, because it's kind of hilarious and tragic how bad this was. And I think that does, you know, kind of put into perspective then why so many Africans, including my father, were prepared to go to war. Because, you know, when he was recruited into his first ever protest, you know, as a young man, 17, 18 years old, the people of his generation, you know, we used to go around saying that the Rhodesian government doesn't understand any language other than violence. And so that's what we have to do. But of course, you know, they get beaten. They have dogs, you know, set upon them, tear gas canisters thrown into the crowd. And my father is rounded up and sent to prison for the first time. But because he's technically a minor, the Rhodesian government believes that the way to deal with what they called minors or native children was to beat them. And so he's kept in prison overnight. And the next day, him and his, you know, fellow inmates are one by one taken out into a courtyard to be flogged.
I'm sorry, is it flogged?
Yeah, flogged, whipped, caned.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's horrendous.
Yes. And so your father, just so the audience gets some sense of who he is and who your mother is. Your father, you call him Taffy, right?
Yes.
And your mother's name is Hope.
Yeah.
The word Hope. I think it's also useful for the audience to understand that part of the underlying tension within your parents' relationship was also that your mother had undergone several miscarriages. I think before she had you, and then she also had another miscarriage after you were born.
Yeah, yeah. So it's worth just saying, to give a little bit of context to their relationship. My father, when he goes into exile in 1974, and he goes to Uganda, my parents meet in their first year of university. So they're very young. And they have a relationship throughout the time that they're undergraduate students. At the end of my father's degree in 1977, he decides that he wants to go back and fight in the war. So it's a full-blown war in Southern Africa at this point. So he leaves Uganda, he leaves my mother behind, and he effectively disappears. Meanwhile, my mother is in a country that's ruled by the notorious Idi Amin. Idi Amin, who may be known to your listeners, is one of the most kind of notorious dictators in African history. He was a flamboyant and populist, unpredictable, capricious tyrant who was famous for, you know, making defiant speeches against the West. But at the same time, he did a number of very damaging things to the country.
You're listening to our interview with Professor Simuka Chigudu about how the histories of Zimbabwe and Uganda have shaped his parents. We'll hear more about Idi Amin, former Ugandan dictator, after this break. Do you like what you're hearing? Well, there's more interview to view, or to like, listen for? Such as stories about college student Simu Cai protesting in Cecil Rhodes' own alma mater, or the major events that caused the older Chikudu to join one of the rebel armies against Rhodesian apartheid government. Just visit our website, BetweenTheBones.fyi, to become a subscriber. We prepare top-of-the-line content here, and we need supporters like you to keep working. Thank you for your support. This is Bridging the Bones, your podcast connecting the dots of conflict. Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Simu Cai Chikudu as we discuss the South Asian influence on Uganda and the implications of African populist strongmen political figures.
He told the Asians in Uganda that they had 90 days to leave the country.
He told the what in Uganda?
The Asians, the Asian community.
Oh, the Asian population. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so just for context, what were the South Asian people, what was their involvement economically with East Africa and South Africa during this period in time?
Well, certainly with in the context of East Africa and Uganda, for centuries, people from the Indian subcontinent would cross the Indian Ocean and come into East Africa for trade of various kinds. So there's this very like long history of an Asian presence in East Africa. In Uganda specifically, they had become a kind of quasi-enclosed community in the country, but running a lot of major and small and medium-sized businesses. In many ways, economic historians, argue that they were the kind of the driving engine of the Ugandan economy as late as the early 1970s when Idi Amin came to power. And people were ambivalent about the Indian community in Uganda. You know, people recognized that they were responsible for bringing in a lot of money into the country, a lot of trade and exchange, but they were also separate and segregated by choice from much of the Ugandan population. And Idi Amin said that he was going to kick them out and redistribute all of their wealth and their homes and their businesses to Ugandans. But when he did this, it caused the economy to crash. He booted out other groups. He would send armed men hunting for anybody who opposed his rule. And these were not very professional soldiers that Amin had at his disposal. You know, some of them were, but a lot of them were just opportunists. And so they just took Idi Amin's rule as a kind of pretext to loot, just to go onto university campuses and pick out young women for themselves. And so this was the atmosphere that my mother was growing up in. And so by the late 1970s, after my father has gone to fight in the war in Southern Africa, Idi Amin is still clinging to power in Uganda. And a rebellion is mounted against Idi Amin. And so there is a civil war in Uganda to remove Amin from power. And so you have this strange parallel where in different contexts, both my parents are caught up in wars. My father is a guerrilla freedom fighter in Southern Africa fighting against the Rhodesian government in one war. And my mother is a civilian caught up in a civil war that's trying to take down the rule of Idi Amin. It's quite kind of dizzying to think about and to make sense of.
I think it's useful for the audience to contextualize this. So your father is from Zimbabwe, or formerly Rhodesia. When he was born, it was called Rhodesia, unfortunately. Yeah. And is he Shona?
That's right. So there are several different ethnic groups in Zimbabwe, but one of the main ones are kind of called the Shona. Which historically is a combination of, different communities, but they're kind of lumped together. And that's the group that my father comes from.
And your mother, though, she was from Uganda.
Yes.
And is
Yeah.
she also Shona?
No, so there aren't Shona in Uganda. So she's part of a community called the Bachiga. And my
Bachiga?
parent, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so my mother is from Uganda, which is in East Africa. And then my dad grew up in Southern Africa. They met in the 1970s when my father was in exile from Rhodesia. He was a political refugee and ended up going to university in Uganda. And it was at university that he took a class with my mother, and that's how their paths crossed.
Going back to the earlier point that I was raising, your mother's miscarriages,
Yeah.
you were still young when one of those occurred. And you note that your father's reaction was basically to worry about what his mother was going to think.
Yeah. Yeah. So
So
yeah.
I think we're seeing some of the ways that this tension between them played out. And it seems like your father was emotionally distant both from you and from your mother.
That's right. So, my parents had been separated for 7 years during these wars that I'm discussing. And they reunited in 1984. And I was born in 86. And I think in the early stages of getting back together, they were optimistic, but also naive about how to rebuild a relationship after a long separation. And also at that time, nobody talked about mental health or post-traumatic stress. There was no rehabilitation for people who had gone through the kinds of things that they had gone through, who had seen, the scale of death and loss that they had been through. And so what happened was they didn't really know how to talk to each other and how to create a more intimate bond. When they were carrying such a heavy load each. And that also meant when unfortunate and sad things happened, like my mother having two miscarriages before I was born, I don't think that they learned how to talk to each other as a couple about that and to process their emotions. But they kept trying to make the relationship work. And that was partly why, as a kid, I intuited that I was the glue holding them together. But when I was 4 years old, my mother had a stillbirth. So it wasn't a miscarriage. She had a child that she carried close to term, who was then stillborn. We don't know the reasons why. This is, something that happens. And I think that the loss was so devastating, and they were not in the habit of finding comfort in each other, that they then kind of retreated into what was comfortable.
Seemingly unable to have additional children, Hope and Toffee place much of their hopes on young Simukai, who eventually realizes he is being prepared for export.
Towards the late 90s, when I was finishing primary school and getting ready to go to high school, there was a lot of debate in Zimbabwe about how the country had a kind of a two-tier education system. There was the education system for the majority of people in the country, and then there were the elite groups of private schools. And these elite private schools, which had been run by Rhodesians and had desegregated, basically taught curriculum and instilled a culture that very much reflected the kind of the values and the outlook of the UK. And so there's a kind of built-in sense that when you were at these schools, your eyes were being directed to the horizon of the Western world rather than to staying in Zimbabwe. So, we didn't learn Shona properly. When we studied history, what they called world history was we studied European history. We learned French and Latin, and we were encouraged to, prepare throughout our education to go to university overseas, South Africa, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And so the Zimbabwean newspaper started to say that the best and the brightest in the country going to these private schools were effectively being trained for export. So their nickname for us was export quality students. And in so many ways, that was what I felt like, that it hadn't consciously occurred to me at that time, because I had just quietly internalized the idea that educational success would mean leaving Zimbabwe. And given that my parents really valued education and had spent so much and sacrificed so much for me to go to these schools, I was determined to get the best education I could, which would ultimately mean leaving Zimbabwe. And so I think that was another part of this kind of alienation that I'm describing.
And during this process of internalizing these values and taking on a heavy emotional burden, because you were still having trouble processing the degree to which your parents had a lot of unspoken and at times spoken, but often unspoken, like resentment and grief and hurt that had been built up over the decades before you were born, that they didn't really quite know how to communicate. So this, I would say, deep-seated anxiety, I don't know, is that correct?
It is.
Yeah, it stayed with you into high school, into college to a large degree. And you do succeed in passing your exams and doing pretty well in school in Zimbabwe. And then you face the prospect of leaving Zimbabwe, right?
And I think there's another aspect to this, which was that from about the year 2000, this is now 20 years after Zimbabwe's gained independence, the country goes through the start of a major political convulsion. And it's a complicated story, but the key bits of context are that the president of the country, Robert Mugabe, and his ruling party are becoming deeply unpopular. That having been in power for so long, there are increasing complaints about deteriorations in living standards, problems in the economy, high cost of living, but also like corruption scandals in the government, and people feeling that the liberation that they fought for was not being delivered. And so Mugabe kind of doubles down and, tries to kind of revivify his standing as the liberator of the country. And that in practice turns into a kind of assault on white people in the country. So he starts taking white-owned commercial farms, which was, a big part of the economy in Zimbabwe, came from agriculture. White people are forced to leave the country en masse. And it's a strange thing because on the one hand, Mugabe is saying all the right things about completing the project of decolonization. On the other hand, he's doing it at a time to try to remain in power and not to properly address long-standing issues in the country. And so the economy tanks. We have sanctions from the European Union, the UK, and the US are imposed on Zimbabwe. We become a bit of a pariah in the country. There are all sorts of human rights concerns. There's lots of political violence. When an opposition party tries to challenge the government, they're frequently beaten by the ruling party's militia. And so it's a really scary time in the country, and a lot of change is happening very quickly. And inflation is skyrocketing every day. The currency is deteriorating. You'd go into shops and clothes and biscuits and cooking oil are disappearing off the shelves. And it just feels like things are going wrong in the country. And so for us at school, we felt it too, because, the fights between the white kids and the black kids now have a political character that reflects the fights that are happening at a national level.
I'm sorry,
Strikes.
you said fights at a national level.
The white kids at school, if their parents' farms were taken, they would have to leave, for instance. And so at the school, like, so it's a really dramatic time. And My parents really wanted me to have a stable education. So even though they themselves, took a very nuanced view about what was happening in Zimbabwe and was sort of sympathetic to some of the things that the government was doing and critical of others, they decided that it would be good for me to complete my high school education abroad because things would be more predictable and stable. And so I went off to finish my final stage of high school at boarding school in England.
So, jumping back to what you were saying about Zimbabwe and the economy, I think it's useful to note that Robert Mugabe, even though he became very dictatorial, he was initially elected, right?
Yes.
Like he didn't just like after the founding of Zimbabwe, like immediately seize power and like control everything by himself. This was a gradual process.
Yeah, I mean, his story is full of all sorts of contradictions. So he was a key player in Zimbabwe's liberation and was hugely popular in Zimbabwe and hugely popular and admired throughout Africa, but not universally. Substantial parts of the Black Zimbabwean population that did not like Mugabe and that did not think he represented them. And so, as early as the 1980s, when he's elected president, rather than trying to, bring on board many of the people who didn't vote for him or didn't want him in power or supported a different leader for Zimbabwe, he would, send portions of the army to exercise massacres and campaigns of repression, including, a period of 5 years in the 80s where a minority ethnic community is violently massacred to the tune of about 20,000 deaths, if not more. So, he was at once democratically elected and popular, but also from the start capable of significant ruthlessness. And this only became more apparent over time until it, really came to a boil in 2000 onwards.
I think some of the people listening are going to, especially people who are of a more culturally European supremacist thinking, are going to listen to this and are going to like sit back and cross their arms and say something like, well, of course, what did you expect from those black people after we, gave them their own country? So I think it's useful to understand some of the larger context for this. I mean, Mugabe himself was an army man, right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, what I would say is that one of the reasons why political rule was so violent was that violence begets violence. I mean, this happens because of how violent European colonial rule was. I mean, when Cecil Rhodes colonized the country, him and the British South Africa Company, which was sort of the vehicle, the army by which they colonized the country, massacred, pillaged, killed, destroyed the Africans that they encountered to about 3 to 4% of the population was killed. If I was to compare that to World War One, the UK and Ireland lost about 1 to 2% of their population in World War One, whereas we lost 3 to 4% of our population under the colonial wars waged by Cecil Rhodes. And then the degree of repression and of segregation and so on was extreme. So, and it, as I said, it took a civil war of, over 15 years to get the Rhodesians out of power. And in all of that time, you are kind of breeding authoritarianism because more democratic political processes don't have time to bed in and become institutionalized and to spread through the country. So I think this is a big part of that helps us to understand the Mugabes of the world. They were made what they were by their historic circumstances. Rather than being like just innately incompetent or something like that.
You were talking about one of the more controversial things that the so-called West paid attention to, which was not so much the massacre of this ethnic minority, but the dispossession of white people of their farms.
Yeah.
But the context of that was, A, that Robert Mugabe didn't do this when he first came to power, and B, that he did actually appeal to the United Kingdom for funds to buy farmland back from white people, but that the UK basically like made an excuse and shut the door on him.
Correct. In fact, I would take it a step further. During the anti-colonial war, it kind of reached a stalemate in 1979. And there was a negotiated settlement that took place in London before Zimbabwe became independent in 1980. And in the series, in the course of those negotiations, the UK promised that they would fund and support the transfer of land once Zimbabwe was independent, but it couldn't happen all at once. It would take some time before that could occur. And so when Mugabe makes an appeal to the UK to say, you know, can you provide funding? That's not coming from nowhere. That's coming, you know, on the specific promises that were made. And those promises were then broken.
And so Britain basically reneged on part of their promise to their colony of close to 100 years, and from which they extracted a great deal of mineral and other wealth.
Yeah, that's right.
In the year 2000, Zimbabwe's President Mugabe feels very challenged, and partly as a way to, I guess, fulfill certain of his promises to the Zimbabwean people, he starts what's basically a land redistribution program. Reading your account of it, it sounds very messy.
Yeah, it was.
And more than that, it also sounds quite violent.
Very much so.
Could you describe a little bit of that? Because I think from the point of view of Europeans and from some people in North America, there's this feeling that white people who had invested in South Africa economically and in terms of building farms, that it was primarily white people who suffered through that process.
Right.
But you know that actually a lot of African farm workers also suffered.
Yeah. As you summarized, one of the strategies that Mugabe uses to complete the decolonization project from the war is to say, we need to finish the work of redistributing farmland and take it from this minority of white commercial farmers who own, you know, vast amounts of the agricultural industry and of commercial farmland, and distribute to impoverished and land-hungry Black people who were expecting this since liberation. And so Mugabe institutes a formal land reform process. At the same time, groups that are calling themselves war veterans, but they're a combination of war veterans and militia, are being sponsored and supported by the government to violently take the land back. So they're squatting on land, they are bullying, harassing, and at times fighting with farmers. And in some instances, these turn deadly, these skirmishes. And white people start to leave the country en masse. But that got a lot of coverage. That story got a lot of coverage in the early 2000s. What didn't get a lot of coverage is the fact that the heaviest toll paid for, you know, the loss of the farmland was not paid by the white farmers, who were, numerically speaking, a minority. They employed, you know, huge numbers, you know, hundreds and thousands of Black farm workers who, when this farmland got taken by the government, often lost their homes and their livelihoods. These were people who would work on the farms, who lived on the farms, and were effectively rendered destitute. And so the taking of the farmland wasn't simply an assault on white people, it was often assault on Black Zimbabweans themselves. And I think that's part of what betrays the double-faced nature of Mugabe's government, because on the one hand, they were claiming that we're doing something radical, progressive, and we're addressing a historic injustice by taking back the land. But on the other hand, they were doing so messily and violently and at the expense of Zimbabweans, because it was part of a bid to remain in power. And in a way, that was the genius and the devilishness of Mugabe, is that he was able to take a very real issue that people were feeling and therefore gained popularity, but played a sleight of hand to try to remain in power. And I think when so much attention was paid to white people, the depth of the violence and the political machinations at work were kind of masked by that.
From what you're describing, it sounds like that while Robert Mugabe was in some ways foregrounding the grievances and the demands of African Zimbabweans, of Native African Zimbabweans, he was also erasing some African Zimbabweans at the same time.
Exactly.
And I think it's also worth noting that the economic problems of Zimbabwe that followed this, part of this was imposed by international lending institutions. But also part of this was that Mugabe, he didn't really like consider what not only removing the white ownership of these farms, but he also kind of destroyed part of the knowledge base of the black farm workers, right? Because the black farm workers had technical knowledge that a lot of the occupiers of those farms after 2000 didn't have.
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. There's been some debate among scholars about, did some of the breakups of the farm allow new kinds of smallholder farmers to be very productive? And, people continue to argue about this. But on balance, I think the story you're telling is correct. And I also think one of the big losses in terms of knowledge was that there was a huge brain drain out of the country, that the dire economic situation in Zimbabwe, just to really stress it, by 2008, so 8 years after this began, inflation in Zimbabwe reached the sextillion percent.
I'm
So,
sorry, what is that? What is that number you're saying? What is sextillion?
I don't actually know how many zeros that is, but functionally it meant that like an individual egg could cost $2 one week and then cost $3 trillion a few months later. I remember being in Zimbabwe in 2008 and buying an ice cream sundae for $38 billion.
Wow.
A running joke in the country was that we had become a nation of starving billionaires. It
Right.
was impossible to kind of fathom. And when you have an economic breakdown like that, you basically don't have a currency. So everybody is trading through other forms of currency, but often illegally. So what happens is, people leave the country, they go work in the US or the UK or South Africa, then they send money in cash, via remittances in hard currency, but not through any official channels. And so if you want to go and buy, gas for your car or get bread and so on, you will go to unofficial gas stations where people have siphoned off fuel and then you trade in hard currency. Or, people would try to get into the various supply chains, buy things wholesale, then trade them informally. So you have this like economic collapse where the formal economy no longer functions, but the informal economy is where all trade and exchange is happening. And for a government, this is disastrous because you basically means you have no revenue, you have no tax base. So you can't fund schools and hospitals and so on. And so doctors don't have work to go to, nurses, teachers, civil servants, to say nothing of the fact that all of these people are also involved in informal trading. It was absolutely nuts and terrible. And this pushed so many people out of the country.
So, I want to close by asking you this more personal question, which is, so you, Simukai, are from Zimbabwe. Your parents are of Shona and Vachiga. So you're ethnically Shona and Vachiga, at least. You were trained in Zimbabwe. You became a fan of Manchester United when you went to Ireland. And you've been teaching in the United Kingdom, but you also have experience as a doctor in Africa. What does that mean for Simukai Chigudu? Like, what does inhabiting all of these different identities, how does that affect you as a person?
It's a tough question to answer, and I think for so long it's been, the central dilemma of my life. A haunting sense of not feeling whole or full anywhere, that I'm kind of my selfhood is scattered in this way. But actually, nowadays it's less a source of agony than it once was, and there are many reasons for that. I think partly, when I left home at 16, I was so young and I didn't really have a foothold in the UK, and that's taken a very, very long time to build a life here. And it's also taken a very long time for me to develop an understanding of my home country and to really put into context my family and political crisis and all that stuff. And one of the things that's changed over time is there's something kind of empowering about feeling like, okay, I have a good understanding of where I come from, what my family went through, and what my country went through. I also, I've lived in the UK for 23 years and I've become a British citizen. And I started kind of, just a kid going to boarding school, and over a period of time have built up, so many friends and enjoyed a lot of professional success here. And in all of those ways, it's helped me develop a sense of personal agency and capacity, a growing, if not always solid, sense of self-belief. I can feel settled wherever I am. And I think I'm also more and more people are in my, predicament, if I can call it that. I've met many more African and African diaspora folks living in the UK, cut off from home or having left home and trying to make sense of where they belong. And that's also created a sense of shared experience, if not identical experience. And I think there is a growing and emerging story about Africans of my generation who are spreading themselves around the world and trying to build lives. And we're kind of underrepresented, I think, in a lot of popular discourse and debate and cultural representation, but yet it's a very alive community. And so for me, I find a lot of solace in that. I find a lot of solace in, accepting that I'm an immigrant and I am Black British and I'm Zimbabwean and I'm Ugandan. And these different parts of me don't have to be at war with each other because I've also started to feel more at peace with just who I am as a person.
And so, if I understand the process of being in the UK for a long time, of forming new friendships, of also developing a greater intellectual understanding of how your background feeds into your feelings, your sense of self. You kind of, to use a cooking analogy, you basically used a lot of different ingredients, and instead of like following a Zimbabwean cookbook or a Ugandan cookbook or a British cookbook or a US cookbook, you kind of looked at a bunch of different cookbooks, and you were able to create a new recipe for yourself from all of
That's
this.
exactly. That's a beautiful way of putting it, and it's a recipe that some people really like and other people won't like. But I think that's the way of putting it. That's a lovely way of putting it.
Well, on that note, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Chigudu. This has been a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, it really has been. Thank you so much for inviting me on, and it's been such a pleasure.
You've just heard a conversation with Suma Kajagudu, professor of African politics at Oxford University. His book, Chasing Freedom, Coming of Age at the End of Empire, is a Crown imprint. Bring to the Bones is an independent podcast, free of influence from Fortune 500 companies, governments, or political parties. You can access bonus material and timestamps for each episode of our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Thanks this week to Swart Ranga for this episode's music titled Melik Beat. This is your host, Sodaline Wang, signing off.